Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, John McKinnon, the author of The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. And together, we're discussing weaponized religion, how Christian identity fused with early Christian fundamentalism and politics to form the foundation for the new apostolic reformation. John, today's episode is critical whenever you think about the NAR and its creation. It's a name that when people think of the NAR, they don't really think of this guy, but he really was the spine of the body that was created in the New Apostolic Reformation. And we've been building up to what I call the epicenter of all of this, which was in the 40s, 1940s. And this guy was critical to the formation of what was coming out of Los Angeles. We're talking about Gordon Lindsay, which Charles and I covered to some degree. And Charles and I talked about his connection to British Israelism. But I was unaware, and Charles was also at the time, that Gordon Lindsay had joined into the Christian identity movement and was speaking as the chief speaker at some of the conventions. And it was at the time in which the Christian identity movement became very anti-Semitic and was developing racist themes. Not to say that Gordon Lindsay was racist or anti-Semitic. We don't know, other than what little bit we can glean from his publications during this period of time. Interestingly, which have all been removed. You can't find a lot of the stuff that he's teaching back then because they deny all evidence, in at least in the communications I've had with Christ for the Nations, indirectly through other people. So Gordon Lindsay founded Christ for the Nations, but before that, he was the leader of the Voice of Healing Revivals. And this was the revival that spearheaded William Branham and launched. Branham actually launched the Voice of Healing publication, and some way or another handed over the management of that to Gordon Lindsay. Branham was the original publisher, and Lindsay became the publisher. And that change occurred right about the time that Latter Rain just became so incredibly large and fast moving throughout the United States and Canada. Likely what happened is that Branham was just simply too busy. He was on the road all the time. But anyway, I'm excited for today because we're going to revisit Gordon Lindsay, the founder of Christ for the Nations, the backbone for what developed many charismatic movements and eventually the NAR. And we're going to evaluate it from the Christian identity standpoint.
Yeah, John, this podcast is going to be really good today. It's going to be fun to do. I did hear your podcast with Charles on Gordon Lindsay, and I think it covered a good bit of ground there. But Gordon Lindsay is a good character to focus on because, like you said, he's probably the start of this movement. He had a lot to do with it. He was very integrated within the movement that eventually became the NAR and what's become of that. But his organization eventually became a training ground to produce ministries. And he was the big promoter of all these ministries back in the 40s. And so he was doing what he did best. He organized these training grounds and had teaching them how to, do the prophetic or gifts of healing and to develop their ministries of the supernatural. So that's what they did. And he had the big names there. You have, William Branham there, maybe Paul Kane and others who were the big names in the healing revival. And they were probably the best teachers of what they were doing. And so he would have those. So he was very cornerstone from what they do today, even out on the West Coast, teaching prophetic gifts and things to people and having these training sessions. It's going on today. But Gordon was the start of all that. Or he was one of the ones that did start that type of ministry to train people. But he believed some very strange doctrines. We'll find he was early on, he was associated with groups that were less than accepted nowadays, thank goodness. But he believed some very strange doctrines about UFOs and aliens and maybe the pyramids, but that's just what came out of the Christian identity groups. And his organization really looks to maybe scrub that early history because they're probably embarrassed by it, of course, and they don't want it to be made public. But so you have to really dig deep to find things, but you can find it in the, of course, the newspapers published it, and they showed where he was speaker at these events and organized these events. And so the history is there, but it's probably not going to be found within his own organization's history unless you look in their vault archives that's hidden away. But I'm looking forward to today's podcast. We got a lot to cover, focusing on Gordon Lindsay and his ministry, early associations with the British Israel and Christian identity groups, and even the Anglo-Saxon Federation of America. And that, as I was looking at that organization, it was very widespread all over the United States. And I even think it's still in existence today, not in the force that it was back then in the 40s and in the 1930s. But, you know, we're going to learn a lot about Gordon today, and I think his history is going to be interesting to our listeners.
Absolutely. And Gordon Lindsay's wife, Frieda Lindsay, she is key in all of this as well. She was trained in the, what is it called, the Life Bible College, I think it is, of the Angelus Temple. And Gordon Lindsay and Frieda both were ministers in the Foursquare Gospel Church, the group of Amy Semple McPherson. And the reason that it's tied to this epicenter, we talked previously about Gerald Burton Winrod, who is one of the most infamous people in the Christian identity movement. Winrod was working later with Charles Fuller and Paul Rader, different various fundamentalist groups. During the spread of the Christian identity movement, he was key in spreading the very anti-Semitic protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which we've mentioned. And this, it was his platform. He believed that the Jews were taking over, they were invading America, they were mixing with communism to plot to overturn world governments for global domination. And many men of that era believed it, men and women, I should say. And honestly, you know, looking back, there's no historical evidence that Gordon Lindsay fell into that camp. However, we have a series of events that suggests that this happened, because Gerald Burton Winrod, as we mentioned, spoke in the Angelus Temple and heavily influenced Wesley Swift. That's documented pretty well. Swift became one of the key figures in the Christian identity movement. And that influence came at the time in which Gordon Lindsay was very, very high up in that organization. He eventually started his own church with Frieda, and they, I think he became something called field manager or something. Anyway, he was the head of a district up north, very close to, adjacent to the North Battleford district, where the Sharon Orphanage would host what became the Latter Rain Revival and launch Latter Rain Movement. He was in that group, and the heads of the Sharon Orphanage were out of the Foursquare Church when they started it. So there's deep connections and deep ties to all of this. But it looks very much, if you line everything up chronologically, it looks very much like whatever Gerald Burton Winrod brought to the Angelus Temple started a strategy of sorts, because not long after this, we start seeing all of the figures come out of the Angelus Temple, and they're starting new organizations, etc., but they're still tied to the same type of framework doctrinally, and they're deeply tied to the Christian identity organizations. And as I mentioned, we have, you know, we've got Gordon Lindsay, who's speaking at conferences for the Christian identity movement, the Anglo-Saxon Federation, and others. So it's all tied. It all comes back to this epicenter that's happening. Whatever, for whatever reason, when the Klan is rebirthed in California, and you've got the Christian identity movement that's gaining a strong foothold in California, all of this ties together. And we don't have all of the pieces of the puzzle, but we have enough to see that it did impact Gordon Lindsay's life, and I think we can very solidly say that.
Yeah, and I think that we'll realize when we study Gordon Lindsay, he was very easy to influence, I think. He could get under the spell of one doctrine and another pretty easily, because I think he was really searching for truth. I think he was sincere in his search for what is truth, and I'm sure he rubbed shoulders with those people that you mentioned, like Wesley Swift, because Wesley Swift was very popular out there in the time, and probably studied the Christian identity doctrine very closely, what he was hearing. And in the early days, as he was developing his views and beliefs that evolved over time, I think we'll see an evolution over time of Gordon Lindsay. But he obviously sided with those groups at one time when they were popular, because he was right up there in the West Coast and those areas in Oregon where they were promoting all that doctrine up there. But Lindsay, to start with, you know, he was literally born out of the and grew up in the atmosphere of the supernatural ministries, because he was born in John Dowie's commune there, and he actually came across Charles Parham in a ministry, actually the one he was saved in, while Charles Parham was preaching, and early Pentecostals, you know, he was with them, so he experienced a lot of that early on, and that's where he developed a lot of his beliefs. And then when he became a minister, he ministered among Christian identity groups for a long period of time. So it's clear why he ministered with them, but I believe over time he migrated away from them as he, you know, realized they were not going to be in the mainstream. And so he probably migrated away from them, as we'll see. But he still had that influence. He still had that background. So it's no surprise that he was captivated by William Branham's ministry when it came along, because he was pastoring a church at the time. And then when William Branham was starting to be known in the United States, he was able to see him or hear about him and went and saw him for himself. And so he left everything after he saw that supernatural ministry, or what he thought was supernatural, and he left everything just to support that, as we'll see. But Lindsay probably saw his ministry as his ticket to security financially and his fame, because here he was, a minister pastoring a church, and he just left the people pretty much high and dry. I'm sure he turned it over to another minister, or they had to select a minister. But, you know, he was truly more of a promoter. He was more of after the supernatural than he was really pastoring a group of people. But he eventually migrated away from Branham as well, and began openly associating and preaching after preaching Christian identity, because Branham, of course, preached doctrines that were very heavily into Christian identity. So he was born 1906, about the time of the Azusa Street Revival, and he was a revivalist preacher himself. That's how he got his early start, even with a tent. And, of course, I said born in John Alexander's commune there. But shortly before Dowie's death, and that city went bankrupt, and his family moved to Dale, Idaho, where his father took a teaching job, you know, at a local high school. And then after that, they moved near Portland, Oregon. He graduated from Beavertown, high school. He enjoyed debate teams, science and math. So there's one thing about Gordon. He was very much interested in science and astronomy and math. And so the analytical mind that he had, that's probably why he latched onto the UFO phenomena and things like that, trying to explain it. He also put things in his publications in Voice of Healing, showing the people how he figured out the dates. So we can see with his mathematical mind, he was very much interested in date setting and the weird things that were going on at the time, the phenomena that people couldn't explain. He thought he had an explanation for them. But he wasn't interested in church at the time, but he really loved engineering, astronomy, math, and science. So that's what he started out with. Then he was asked to attend a revival at the church of John G. Lake. And we know John G. Lake came out of Dowie's organization as well. And then Charles Fox Parham was the one that was preaching when he became a Christian. And he saw many supernatural things at those meetings. And that's his first start, you know, as a Christian. And not long after that, he enters the ministry. And he actually gets, he was 18 years old. 1 year after his conversion, he did feel the call to preach. So we'll go into that in a few minutes about how he got started preaching.
Right. And the figures that you're mentioning, you know, John Alexander Dowie, John Lake, the different cults that he's involved with, plays a key role, I believe, in what was created. Because if you look at the timeline, as he is learning to become a minister, he's being trained by some outright scoundrels. I mean, I think we've fully covered John G. Lake and his antics at this point. But John G. Lake was a Paramite in the camp of Dowie. As Dowie was losing his mental faculties, Parham tried to take over Dowie's multi-million-dollar empire by claiming to be another Elijah prophet. And we've covered the series of events that happened there pretty well, the murders, the Paramite murders, they're called. And so Gordon Lindsay's parents were in the Paramite sect there in Zion City. And whenever all of this happened and everything just kind of dissolved, they moved away. Well, Gordon Lindsay connects again with John G. Lake. He was very, very young, I think, in Zion City, as I understand the timeline. But he connects with these Paramite guys. He's connecting directly to Charles Fox Parham. He's holding revivals with John G. Lake. And whenever he gets connected to Angelus Temple, many of these characters are still connected to the Pentecostal circles through Amy Semple McPherson's church. So if you look at the way the NAR network works today, where you've got all of these apostolic groups that are all connected through the NAR network, it seems as though the Angelus Temple was an early prototype for all of this. Her group was connecting to all of these different various movements, and interestingly was connected directly to the Christian Identity through leaders such as Gerald Burton, Winrod, and others. And if you look at the timeline, you know, the CFNI, in exchange of emails that I've had with CFNI and others, they deny the British Israelism and the Christian Identity connections to Gordon Lindsay. But if you go to the Flower Pentecostal Heritage Center, this group, it's a Pentecostal group, archive, if you will, that they store records of Pentecostalism, and they're very open and transparent. I've had a lot of huge discoveries out of this place, and if you pull up their page on the records of authored by Gordon Lindsay, you're going to find that he authored a series of articles, not just one but multiple, for the Christian Identity Anglo-Saxon Christian World Movement. And they've got them listed right here on their, you know, on their Flower Pentecostal Heritage Center page. But this is in 1940, and that's approximately the time, maybe a little bit shortly after, the time in which he is speaking at Christian Identity conferences. And 1940 was just 2 years after Gerald Winrod came to Angelus Temple. So again, you see the trail of events. Gerald Burton Winrod comes to Angelus in 1938. 2 years later, you've got Gordon Lindsay, who's publishing in Christian Identity newsletters, and some of the articles, they have it listed, I think, as British Israel if you do keyword searches, but or Anglo-Israelism, I think they call it. But the groups in which he's publishing for at this period of time, according to their timelines, has shifted into Christian Identity, the more anti-Semitic version. So you've got the leader of anti-Semitism in the United States, Gerald Burton Winrod, who's coming to Angelus, and then 2 years later, Gordon Lindsay. It looks very much like he became a disciple of Gerald Burton Winrod in the same way that Wesley Swift became a disciple. So out of all of that is birthed eventually the Latter Rain Movement, CFNI, which literally that was the backbone of what created the Charismatic Movement. So you've got all of these trails that come back to this epicenter in time where Gerald Burton Winrod is the key to unlocking all of these doors.
Yeah, I think you said that very well. You know, you see all the trails that come back to that, and Gordon came out of that, and so that was said very well. And Gordon, you know, he got his start in ministry. He bought a tent from John G. Lake and a couple of his friends that he had. They went on the gospel trail, you know, carrying their tent around place to place. But he was conducting meetings in Assembly of God churches and British Israelite churches and other Pentecostal groups. And eventually he became sick. He had ptomaine poisoning. And at that time, he stayed in Lake's home, John G. Lake's home at the time. And he studied his sermons. He tried to read the Bible and all to help his faith for his healing. So he just said if he could just believe if he would dare to accept it, he would the scriptures in Mark 11:22, what things you desire when you pray, believe you receive them. He hung on to that scripture and really believed for his healing. But he got over that, and in 1932, by that time he had conducted 150 meetings or more. And in one meeting during that time, he had only one convert in one of the meetings he conducted, and it was a girl named Frida. So that was where he met his wife. She was one of the converts of his meeting. 5 years later, they were married and moved to California. So there he is right there in California, in San Fernando, California, right near, you know, Los Angeles and, you know, Amy Simple McPherson's temple and Burton Winrod. So, you know, he was influenced by that because he was already preaching in British Israel churches. And then he began to promote British Israelism and Christian identity. In 1938, he was appointed for field extension work for Amy Simple McPherson and Gerald Burton Winrod, and had also been given the pulpit of McPherson at the time because she was absent for a period of time. And he also has connections to George Hallton and Wesley Swift, as we said. But the Anglo-Saxon Saxon Christian World Federation was organized in 1938, and in 1940, his involvement there, they organized a large convention in 1940 in Vancouver, British Columbia, and he was responsible for that. And the speakers in that time included Clem Davies, whom we mentioned that toured with Avok Hagopian a while back. And Clem Davies was a KKK recruiter, promoter of the early version of Christian identity. And then when World War II broke out, Lindsay accepted the call to become a pastor, you know, in early 1940. So the history of that British Israel doctrine and United States and the movements that came along with that, they're a lot different than the UK, because it became very racist in America, whereas the UK just, they didn't focus on racism so much, but it was a racist doctrine. So beneath the Christian identity umbrella there, you've got the Lord's Covenant Church that was formed, the Anglo-Saxon Federation of America, Aryan Nations, the Phineas Priesthood, Church of Jesus Christ Christian. And Anglo-Saxon Federation was one of the longest lived one. And as we might not have mentioned yet, but Howard Rand, you know, was the one that was responsible for starting that. And we mentioned that how Rand was associated with Cameron, with the Dearborn Independent and Protocols of Zion and so forth. But Aryan Nations was established later on in 1970. So these groups kept continuing to be formed out of this one organization here in 1940. Swift was the one that popularized the two-seed theory, and that was eventually picked up by Branham. So I know Gordon was very much, he was knowledgeable of all these doctrines that Branham eventually preached, and when he eventually joined him. So it was widespread. Anglo-Saxon Federation was widespread all over America. They were having meetings from coast to coast, and they were actually sympathetic to Hitler, and they actually made the Bible fit their theory of the white people being the 10 lost tribes, fulfillment of Bible prophecy. So that was what they were all about. But Gordon Lindsay spoke on the U.S. and Britain in prophecy, and was during those Christian identity meetings, he was involved with the Four Squares Church and preached within those circles. And Four Square, of course, was sympathetic to Christian identity in the Klan in the 1920s and 30s also. But there's many things to be said about that. We'll skip over some of that. But all this British activity, British Israel activity was occurring in Oregon. At the time, Gordon Lindsay was coming of his own in his own ministry. So that's where he became easily influenced. And the Christian identity was starting to be developed and introduced that serpent seed doctrine. But Lindsay, over time, I think because I don't think he totally believed what Branham was preaching in 1958 with serpent seed doctrine. You never see him latch on to that over time. I think he evolved out of that and maybe distanced himself from it because it was very unpopular, of course, in the Pentecostal circles.
You know, everything that you've just said has wasted so many hours of my time trying to research and find the answers. And I don't think you'll ever find them. That's the hard part of this. Because if you, all the names that you've mentioned, you know, Clem Davies and these others, they're all starting what looks to be the rebirth of the California Ku Klux Klan. But there's no clear evidence of it. The only evidence that we see very clearly is that Wesley Swift was spearheading the revival of the Klan not long after Roy Davis goes out to, you know, his orphanage scheme that he had out there, when all of this epicenter is happening, there is, not long after this, the rebirth of the California Klan, which is interesting. But Clem Davies, obviously a Klan guy, obviously a Christian identity guy, he's speaking in the same conferences as Gordon Lindsay. And we've seen, I think we've covered it in this one, it's either this podcast or the one I do with Charles, that Amy Semple McPherson, her church, after her big kidnapping scandal, it looks very much like the Klan came to her aid, and she met with leaders of the Klan not long before the Klan starts helping her escape her criminal suit, etc. So there's all these ties, but the problem is, at that point in time, there is no clear connection between any of them and the Klan, other than what we see in the newspapers, such as McPherson meeting with them, etc. But even Roy Davis, when he goes out and he sets up his orphanage scheme, there's no clear evidence from any of the newspapers or public records that he is rebirthing the Klan, and we know he is because he later becomes the Imperial Wizard. At that point in time, the Klan had largely gone underground, and you have a few key figures like Clem Davies, who is openly broadcasting the fact that he's in the Klan. But for the most part in California, that's not the case. They've gone underground, and you don't really know which organizations are Klan and which are not unless you look at the key figures in them. And yet they all seem to come back to connections to the Angelus Temple, which is very interesting for me. So I see, like you said, I see Gordon Lindsay heavily influenced by all of this. He's working with the same people. At minimum, he did not denounce them and part ways. So if these people are anti-Semitic and they're preaching two-seed racist doctrines, which they were, and Gordon Lindsay is still speaking in their conferences, I have to believe that he was aligned with them, or he would not have spoke in their conferences. But then, like you said, you get closer to the 1950s and 1958, there is a clear separation of ways. And so when I initially come across this, I thought, well, Gordon Lindsay must have just denounced it like the rest of them. But I came to understand, and this is my opinion, he's not here to ask him, he's dead. But my opinion is that he separated more for an opportunist standpoint than anything. Because there is clear evidence that he and Branham were having difficulty working with each other well back into the, like 1953, long before the Serpent Seed. So there was something, before William Branham went public with his Serpent Seed, there was something else causing a division between these two guys. And Charles and I did cover this pretty well. There's multiple times in which Gordon Lindsay snubs Branham, and, you've got the battle between Gordon Lindsay and the Voice of Healing and Joseph Mattson Bosey, the Herald of Faith. And then it builds up into this other weird epicenter. You've got Jim Jones. As soon as Gordon Lindsay is parting ways or on his way out, Jim Jones is stepping up to be a leader in Branham's sect of the Message and through Joseph Mattson Bosey and others. And not long after this rift between, Branham says it was 300 ministers. I don't know the actual number, but they all rose up against him over the Serpent Seed doctrine. Branham preaches Serpent Seed. Everybody starts sending death prophecies against Branham. And it looked like the movement largely wanted to disconnect from Branham. And that's the point in time in which Gordon Lindsay does. And so Gordon Lindsay, in 1958, I think it's March, it may be slightly before, but this is immediately after the death curses are placed on Branham. Voice of Healing changes its name to Worldwide Revival. So if you think of the NAR and the Worldwide Revival themes that are in the NAR, this was the birth of it. And he was spawning off new ministers that, many of them were what developed into the Charismatic movement. But the name was changed. And it didn't do very well because Branham's name wasn't in it. So it later changed back to the Voice of Healing. So we see this weird parting of ways, but then he comes back and Branham comes back. And towards the end of his life, I think Charles and I covered this recently, but you've got Gordon Lindsay publishing the Elijah Doctrines right at Branham's death. It looks like it was an opportunist separation to me more than something having to do with Christian identity. I don't know that Gordon Lindsay fully separated in his mind the how wrong that doctrine was versus how much money could be made off of not having it. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
Yeah, I think there's underlying all of his ministry, there's probably still that in the back of his mind, and you know, he probably never let go of it totally once he was exposed to it. So yeah, that's very likely. They weren't very public about it, but you know, it's like you said there. I think they must have some unwritten rule amongst themselves, or they must have some gentleman's agreement to never denounce each other or other ministries publicly, even though they bitterly disagree with them. They never will state, you know, that, or either they're just, you know, secretly still siding with them like Gordon may have, because they never denounce each other. Just like Branham and Davis, you know, no matter what Davis did from the pulpit, you know, Branham never said, well, you know, I don't associate with Davis anymore because of this or that. It was always, you know, a very positive thing all the way up to the end. But after the mid-1950s, it appears like Gordon wasn't actively involved in the cause of Christian identity to make his priority, of course, and he eventually shifted and became totally interested in the miracles, the healing, the sick, and ministry, because I guess he knew that's where the money was. He was always flowing to where the most money could be made there. But he was exposed to a lot of things in the circles of British Israelism, Christian identity, that he eventually carried over into those in his later ministry, which was the secrets of the pyramids, astrology, and he was very interested in those things. But he was, and this may have been why he latched on the ideas, more weird stuff like focus on UFOs and men from other worlds, numerology and pyramidism. Leaders within those groups thought they knew how to decode the pyramid. There's even been books written on how they could use the pyramid to decode the times by means of the numerology and the steps in the pyramid and the different chambers and what it all meant. And so Gordon published a lot of that in his Voice of Healing publications. You know, Branham also was in on that. He believed in what British Israelism and Christian identity believed about the pyramids. And he went so far as to say the pyramids was one Bible, you know, that God wrote, you know, through man. By man building it, he wrote a Bible. And he was emphatic about that all his life. That was one of the Bibles, as well as astrology, how the, you know, the planets are lining up. So if that's true, then I can see why the men were trying to decode the secrets if they really believe that. And I'm surprised we didn't hear more about that from Branham's ministry. But, you know, it's strange, even though here Branham is supposed to be the prophet and saying, well, the stars is a Bible and the pyramid's a Bible, I don't see many ministers of the message today trying to decode the pyramid. Now, obviously, they must not believe, or they must not think that it's really a Bible, because I think if they did, they would be trying to teach their flock. Why wouldn't they be trying to teach their flock about the pyramids? So it looks like they don't believe a lot of that nowadays, and there's not much study on the subject of astrology and so forth, and not much is mentioned about that. But Branham was very vocal about that many, many times. I don't know how many times he mentioned it, but it was over and over. So Gordon tried to integrate those strange beliefs, the esoteric, into what God was doing in this revival and preparing people for the end of days. That's what it's always spun, is we're at the end of days and all these things mean something, from the pyramids to the UFOs. And his interest in science and astronomy probably carried over into the ministry while he was doing all that. He actually thought he had found the divine pattern at one time on the times of wars in Israel's history. So in 1940, and this was the time he was very connected with those circles, he wrote a book called Blueprints of God, and that was an interpretation of scriptures in accord with mathematical science. So there he is again, writing from his background and his interest in science. But the writers of the newspaper articles were supportive of Lindsay in this effort. They even said he was highly accurate in his predictions. And it's just a promotion for his book. But this is an example of a man's predictions of prophetic events can be woven into the present time. I mean, he was obviously wrong, because a book written back then just kind of faded out of history. Nobody's saying that's a very true book today. But it just goes to show you can do just about anything you want and weave it into the, you can make a prophetic announcement and weave it into the fabric of what's happening today. Just like in Branham's case, he said he made all these prophecies back in 1933. And now today we're even weaving those into the election cycle we see, the end of the world. We're still hanging on to those prophecies and interpreting the world through those prophecies when they may not have been even prophecies at all, because we see how they changed so much over time. It's the same way here. We get this view of the world, and then we have cognitive dissonance kicks in, and then we just begin to modify our beliefs as things happen and evolve. And it's done over and over again. You know, you take all the prophecies that were supposed to come to pass. If they don't come to pass, people will find an explanation and just roll with it. And they won't wake up and realize that what's been spoken is very false. It's very similar to Nostradamus's writings and others. You know, people take the quatrains that he wrote and try to weave them into all that's happened in history. And you can do that if you allow yourself to do it. You can take anything just about and weave it into a story that fits, you know, your worldview. So you have to be very careful with those things, you know, and, you know, especially when a prophet's proven to speak false prophecy, you don't want to be taking what he said as the gospel truth and try to weave it into your worldview, because you're definitely going to come out wrong. And I think that's what's happening, definitely what's happening today over and over again, and say in the NAR, with people being prophesied over, and we see the ministries that's been prophesied over, and then they begin to fall apart. You know, it's just what happens. So the Christians in the nation were becoming aware of the end times. We've had two world wars happen here, and in that short span of time, World War One and Two, and then eventually the Korean War. So they were very interested in what was happening in Israel. You know, 1948 was approaching, and Israel was becoming a nation then. So that's about the time that Lindsay and Branham connected. So we'll begin to see what happened through their ministries here shortly.
Yeah, and you mentioned the UFO doctrines that Gordon Lindsay had. For me, that's key to understanding and unlocking the Christian identity themes that are flowing through the ministry. Because, again, Gordon Lindsay came out of Angelus Temple, influenced by Gerald Burton Winrod. He's preaching UFO doctrines. You've got Wesley Swift, came out of the Angelus Temple, heavily influenced by Winrod. He's preaching UFO doctrines. And Steve Montgomery and I have covered this pretty well in our Converging Apostasy podcast. But the esoteric themes that Steve calls the Converging Apostasy, where you've got all of these mysticism and Gnosticism and all of these things that aren't Christian that are embedding itself into the Christian religion, some of these came in through the Christian identity movement. And the UFO is one of the more significant ones, because the Christian identity movement had this doctrine in which you had your physical bodies here on earth, but you had a spiritual component that was out in outer space. And as time got closer to the end, the heavenly bodies were supposed to be coming back in alignment with the earthly bodies. It's a weird doctrine and not something that I can even sum up in a paragraph. There's a lot of complexity to it, because it was intended to confuse the people such that they could never understand it. But Branham teaches this, Lindsay teaches this. And if you go to the CFNI website, which I just did right now to make sure that it wasn't, that they haven't changed it, but You can go to books by Gordon Lindsay, and you're not going to find any of his Christian Identity or UFO Doctrine books on their website, completely erased from his history. But if you go to northwest.edu, you can find books such as the 1966 book, The Mystery of the Flying Saucers. And he's making the argument that, you know, these signs that you see, he calls them signs in the sky, these flying saucers, they're not something that can be tangibly explained. And so therefore, he ties it to exactly like Swift does, the angelic beings like from the Book of Enoch. He ties it to this kind of thing. So he is preaching Wesley Swift's doctrine, 1966. This is the year after William Branham died. And he's carrying the torch forward because Branham taught very similar things to what you find in this book. But again, you go to the CFNI website, you're not going to find any reference to this stuff. They have completely whitewashed it. And whenever I see this kind of thing happening, whenever groups are not transparent and they deny their own history, it is one of the strong marks towards a destructive cult, because that is what a destructive cult does. It erases its history and pretends it never happened. And like I said, in the correspondence that I have been involved with through other people talking to CFNI, they outright deny that it happened. And yet we've got the archives, and you can go even online, you can just do online searches, and you can find that what they're saying isn't quite true.
Yeah, John, I agree with you definitely on those points there. So by the time Lindsay and Branham connected together, he ran into Branham's ministry through the efforts. It was Jack Moore. Jack Moore introduced William Branham to Lindsay in 1947. And so Gordon Lindsay was well groomed for what he was going to encounter here and what he was going to get into, and he was going to go big time in the nation and just be right there in the midst of all that was going on with the healing revivals. But William Branham was a start, and Moore invited. Moore had heard of Branham's meetings in Arkansas, invited him to minister in Shreveport, and then Jack contacted Lindsay to introduce him to Branham at that time. And Lindsay took a leave of absence from his church and a tour with Branham, and soon resigned from his own ministry, as we mentioned before. And they established the Voice of Healing in 1948, and Lindsay gradually took it over fully because, Branham left the field for a time. But Lindsay just had all these ministries flooding into his organization, and he was the big promoter of all of them and just popularized many ministries at the time, like Oral Roberts, A.A. Allen, and just dozens of others, you can look them up. But Gordon and his wife just left all they had built up in their ministry to that point and put all their efforts into one person. And the Voice of Healing magazine talks about the meetings going on for 3 years. So in 1949, the magazine mentions that. So that would put it at about 1946, even way back then. But after that heavy load, and Branham would stay there hours and hours trying to pray for everybody, he got overworked and left the field. And, I'm really glad for Frieda's candid statements in her diary, because that's where you find some of the inside information about what happened there. And I'm glad we have those comments, because she said he basically left them high and dry and just said, it's your ministry, you started it, and it's your baby now. So that's kind of how she put it, is that they didn't know what to do, and they were, seeking God for what's their next thing. But they eventually survived it, because they put all their eggs in one basket, but they eventually survived it, fortunately, because of all the other ministries that were being formed, mostly taking inspiration for how Branham was conducting his ministry, and they believed they could do the same, and obviously they did, many very much like what Branham was doing, and they were all successful in promoting the healing, message. So the revivalists at that time, Gordon just latched on to them and began to promote them. And there was no shortage back in those days. William Freeman was one. He was holding just small meetings in small churches. And Lindsay visited one of his campaigns and just felt it was the will of God to team up with him. So he teamed up with different ministers. He would key in on one minister basically and work with him if he was going to work with a particular ministry. So he worked with Freeman, and there's others throughout the years you'll see in the newspapers, that he actually would focus in on and just work with them exclusively while still promoting everything in his Voice of Healing magazine. But it's interesting, in 1949, you know, this was 5 years after Upshaw and Davis's disaster in California and the Usher Davis Foundation. And Upshaw was still in the picture. He made his way into the Voice of Healing, writing a couple of articles. And, you know, Gordon actually allowed it. And I'm sure Gordon knew the history there. And I'm sure Gordon knew Roy Davis and knew of Upshaw and his involvement and the scandal out there. But that's just a very short time after that. Davis has given a large space to writing in his an article in 1950, even. We may can examine that very closely. It's and what was said in that sometime in the future. But Davis was back in Texas by this time in his work, and Lindsay's inclusion of that and what Davis said in the article says that he was still associating with the, you know, British Israel Christian Identity circles, because that was heavily what Davis was involved with. So he was still allowing that in his publication. So he still has some connections there. The Voice of Healing in 1949 had grown to nearly 30,000 subscriptions per month, and it was clearly the voice of the healing movement. It was definitely spreading the message that they were preaching there. So they did promote Branham heavily in the early days, but then they began promoting other ministries as well. F.F. Bosworth was in the picture, Raymond Ritchie, O.L. Jaggers, Gil Jackson, just many, many of those famous ministers back in those days. The following year, there was the convention that they had met in Kansas City, and every revivalist in the nation was there. William Branham was not, and Oral Roberts was not. That was kind of interesting, but Lindsay exposed several points of danger and tension in the movement that was gathering, and then proposed guidelines for the future. So already by 1949, so when they organized that convention, they were having tensions building in the movement. Part of it was over doctrine, and they said, we're just going to promote unity among the brethren. We're not going to be promoting doctrine. And so that was partly the reasons for some of the divisions that were occurring. Probably some of the other things was maybe the Christian Identity circles was creeping in and becoming a part of the broader movement, and maybe they wanted to stay out, you know, not that be the dominant theme. So he was trying his best to deal with those issues, and in an article announced the purpose, plan, and policy of Voice of Healing, he denounced the freelancers who violently and indiscriminately attacked the organization in general. He urged avoidance of novel prophetic interpretations, so dogmatic doctrinal assertions, sectarian predilections, and theological hair splitting. So already they were having a little trouble, you know, amongst themselves and trying to agree with one another as this movement made headway. Then the Voice of Healing convention was just a loose association in 1950 of all the healing revivalists, and officially they held Voice of Healing held what they call family meetings at the convention. At the same time, they wanted to prove to the world that those associated with the Voice of Healing had no intention to organize another movement. You know, they just wanted to remain a loosely associated, you know, convention. Through the decade, the conventions were showcasing healing, revivalism, and there were workshops. And this is what began, I think, Lindsay's start in his eventual formation of Christ for the Nations and the training sessions that he had, because they had workshops on the problems of healing evangelists. Typical topics were like prayer and fasting, preparation for a campaign, the follow-up work that's necessary after the campaign, the system of prayer cards for the prayer tent and the healing line, and delicate issue of finances. So that began to grow from those seeds there. He was teaching them how to run your program, basically. And then the association grew in importance in the 1950s and was headed by Oral Roberts or Branham through those years. And every new revivalist that came on the scene wanted to learn from this, because that was the start of it. They wanted to learn the techniques they needed to be successful on the field. So that's how he got his early start there. You know, and forming these training sessions, which became his organization, Christ for the Nation, eventually.
Right. And those training sessions and everything that you've discussed is key to understanding how this evolved through into the charismatic movement and eventually the NAR. A lot of people do not give Gordon Lindsay the proper credit for the creation of the NAR, because he, from the surface, it looks like he is separated from extremism. But you go back to some of the more extremist doctrines that were coming out of leaders that were being chastised. You got William Branham, and he's teaching openly the Christian identity two-seed doctrine, and you have others with the manifest sons of God, etc. And they develop into some very extremist cults, and Gordon Lindsay has separated himself from them. And you can clearly tell by reading through his magazine, The Voice of Healing, that he's making a shift away from the extremists. However, at the same time, the core doctrines by the extremists seem to have remained in his ministry, which is odd when you think about it. In our podcast that we do on William Freeman, Chino Ross and I talk a good bit about the Man-Child Doctrine, which was basically, it was a rebranding of the Manifested Sons of God doctrine. And we've also discussed this in the podcast that I'm doing with Steve Montgomery, The Converging Apostasy, how the esoteric themes entered into the revivals as the Man-Child Doctrine, and this began the birth of the early form of spiritual warfare that the NAR has adopted. Well, in 1961, here's another book, and I searched it also on the website just now to make sure that CFNI isn't publishing this, but I could not find their reference to Gordon Lindsay publishing the book The Sun-Clothed Woman and the Man-Child, which is essentially his rebranding of the Manifest Sons of God doctrine. This is the notorious Christian identity doctrine that entered into the latter rains, latter rain revivals. And William Branham took this to far extremes. I think I've covered it very thoroughly that this is what really radicalized Jim Jones. The Manifested Sons of God doctrine was not only heretical, but very dangerous in the wrong hands, and we see what happened with Jones. Gordon Lindsay is still working with all these revivalists, and like you just said, he's holding these seminars where he is training revivalists. So he is bringing Christian identity themes into the training, and Gordon Lindsay continues to train these guys, even after William Branham's death. Why CFNI erases this history, I don't know, but I can see it looks very it looks very dirty what they have done in removing this, because Gordon Lindsay's part in this appears to be a lot deeper involved than what it appears from the whitewashed version that they're giving CFNI.
Yeah, and Lindsay, as his ministry grew and as he went through the 1950s, that was the heyday of the healing revival. He was really, one comment by one author said, Lindsay was more than an advisor during the first decade of the healing revival. He was much like the director of an unruly orchestra. You know, he tried to tell people to go slow, don't try to be the Hollywood showman, you know, make sure you're on a solid ground before you get started. That was his caution. But so through the 1950s, by 1958, which we've mentioned a couple of times, many of the revivalists just believed that his work was over. But that was about the time he was starting to form his new organization. But many of the revivalists probably thought, you know, the healing revival had cooled off by that time. So they thought his work was over. But it's interesting, when going back to 1947, that was the year that he took his first trip to Israel. So Lindsay was becoming worldwide even early on, but he went to Israel and worked to spread the gospel in Israel. Now, this was early on when he was working with Branham, so I find it very odd that, Branham had said when he was taking his trips overseas that the Holy Spirit specifically said, do not go to Israel because they're not ready for this gospel yet and it's not their time. But that's, you know, for one thing, that's totally contrary to Scripture, because Paul said, you know, I would that my brethren would be saved. They need the gospel. And Gordon Lindsay recognized that even above what Branham did. So he wasn't told to stay out of Israel. So he took it to Israel. But I'm thinking that, you know, maybe William Branham was a little bit afraid to go to Israel, because if he took his ministry before the true Jew, they might have figured him out. you know, and said, hey, you're not really a true prophet at all. But Lindsay established the Jerusalem Center, and that became a chapel on the Mount of Olives. And his daughter actually traveled to Israel many times and later married a man with Jewish descent, and she eventually immigrated to Israel. His daughter and husband have an Israel ministry now in Tel Aviv, so that continues to this day. So I thought that was an interesting tidbit. So I think by the 1960s, you know, Lindsay's focus really changed because the healing revival was almost gone as far as what it was doing, and he was no longer promoting all these new evangelists coming on the scene. So in 1961, he launched what's called the Native Church Program to help Native churches complete construction on their church buildings. And to date, he's helped over 12,000, or his organization has helped over 12,000 churches worldwide. So I think that's where his redemption came out of all of this, and out of all his ministry focus in the early days, which, you know, he may have still held a lot of those views, but if you can say he had any redeeming quality out of it all, you know, he formed an organization that sought to help other churches, and these were indigenous peoples. These were not just focus on Christian identity circles. This was actually other Christian churches throughout the world, and focused on spreading the gospel. So it was less on the esoteric and the pyramids and the UFOs by that time, and it was more on focusing on the gospel. So I think we can say, you know, he had a point of redemption there, and he still held and promoted the Pentecostal message, though, but he left his focus on all that deliverance evangelism. And that was probably out of necessity because it was just cooling off by that time. He had long held his associations with white supremacists that he associated with 1940s. He eventually didn't live to see the end of what was coming for his organization, which I think was as close to redemption as he could get. His ministry lived on and was carried on by his family. So that's where I see the evolution occurring, you know, in his ministry. You know, he was willing to search out matters to find out if he was right or wrong due to his analytical mind, you know. So I think he may have eventually changed some of his views, but we don't know that. There's no evidence of any of that. But in 1967, the name was changed from Voice of Healing finally to Christ for the Nations. And he remained in the organization. He renamed it Christ for the Nations to reflect the growing missionary focus of the organization. And he led that organization until his death. Eventually, he evangelized other countries. He started in Mexico with this. And one of the meetings that he was also in was William Branham's South Africa trip in 1951 as he was branching out. But his books have been translated into 80 languages over time. He even started a radio station in Central America to promote, you know, the gospel. Many, many churches built. But there's that's just what Gordon Lindsay was all about, I think, in the end. But, you know, he died prematurely. He died in 73, I believe, right there while they were conducting a service. So probably premature, and it was probably sad for the organization because he was just getting started, you know, really in what he was doing there with Christ for the Nations.
Right. From all signs, it looks like Gordon Lindsay had a significant shift in his theology and ministry. It's hard to pinpoint exactly when that happened because, like the books I've mentioned, it's before and after William Branham's death. There's clear evidence that he still holds on to those beliefs, but it did shift over time. And so one could look at that and say that there is some redemption for his ministry. For me, it's... nothing is black and white. For me, it's more complicated than just a yes, he reformed, or no, he didn't reform. For me, it's more like a birthday cake. You make a birthday cake, it looks good, some of it may taste good, but drop just a drop of poison in that. And do you really want to eat it? Maybe you can eat it and not get sick, but there's a drop of poison in it. And what I see from all of these books that he's published, I see a clear sign of the Christian identity from start to finish throughout his ministry, at least as late as 1961, maybe later. And then suddenly, you know, after JFK was assassinated, all of the white supremacy and many of the Christian identity groups went underground. And so they didn't openly say the things that they thought, because otherwise they might accidentally find themselves under federal investigation. So not just Gordon Lindsay, but many others have the appearance of redemption in their ministries. Can I say that that's the case with Gordon Lindsay? No, but I don't know what happened with him. I see that about the same time that everything else went underground, Gordon Lindsay has a significant shift in his ministry. Christ for the Nations is birthed, and he has, like you said, a global significant influence in the formation of what eventually would lead to the birth of the NAR. So we've identified the, you know, the manifest sons of God doctrine that is taught in the NAR. We see Gordon Lindsay teaching it, the spiritual warfare, we see him teaching that. And then there's the shift and it becomes the NAR. So very clear ties back to it. Whether or not that was the due to the Christian identity in his later years, I don't know. It does, like you say, look like there is a shift in his ministry and he's redeemed. So a lot to cover. We've only skimmed the surface of this. You can dig into Gordon Lindsay and you can, you know, all of the Voice of Healing magazines, you can go read them. They're all out there on the internet, and they're all, I believe they're all in the public domain, so you can even reference them. But it is the backbone for the NAR, and a lot of people miss the impact that Gordon Lindsay had. So much more we could cover, John, but we've got so many more trails that are leading back to this epicenter, and I'm excited for next week whenever we explore deeper some of these connections.
You know, John, you mentioned with Gordon, one thing that came up in my research here and your research too, as you know, you mentioned JFK and all that about going on at the time in the early 60s when the Christian identity basically went underground, and that was right about the time the Gordon's organization was formed. But Gordon was a Dallas man. He was you know, in that area, and we know that Roy Davis was very much in Dallas, and Davis lived in Oak Cliff in Dallas. And also the newspaper articles, when Gordon died, they mentioned that last rites for the Reverend Gordon Lindsay, founder and president of Christ for the Nations in Oak Cliff. So Oak Cliff has an interesting history with white supremacy, and there's some strange coincidences here I'll mention. Of course, we know it was the location of Roy Davis's activities with the White Citizens Council. It was the location of a theater where Lee Oswald was found after the assassination of Kennedy. And in FBI records, it says, I read this, a man named Jack Davis says he saw Oswald at the theater. Now, we know Jack Davis was one of the aliases of Roy Davis. I don't know if there's a connection there for that, but I know Oak Cliff has a very strong history with white supremacy. So, you know, Gordon Lindsay was still right in the middle of all that.
Yeah, I know. That's, for me, that's the reason why I say that it's hard for me to go fully towards redemption, even though, like I said, it looks like he did. But he's sitting right there. Roy Davis is the head of the White Citizens Council in Oak Cliff. And the printing presses that were publishing the Wanted for Treason, they were Roy Davis's printing presses, it looks like, from the FBI documents. There's so much that happened there in Oak Cliff. And we're not talking about a big place. This is a plot of land. It's a neighborhood. It's about the size of, I think it's like 2 miles by 4 miles wide in Dallas. This is a tiny place where everybody, back then, everybody knew everybody. So it's hard for me to believe that Roy Davis, who's working closely with Branham, who's living in Gordon Lindsay's neighborhood, was not in some way connected to Gordon Lindsay. Gordon Lindsay published Davis's articles in the, you know, in the Voice of Healing. He's publishing the second in command of the original Klan, the highest ranking member of the original Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He's publishing the Klan guy in his Voice of Healing newsletter, and he's living in the neighborhood next to him. So there's so much here. Like I said, we're skimming the surface. There is so much more we could go into with Gordon Lindsay. And is it definitive proof that he was in the Klan or remaining Christian identity after Branham died? No, we can't find definitive proof because all of these groups are underground. They all concealed their history, and the sect that Davis was in, all their records were burned shortly, you know, after the Kennedy assassination. They burned everything. So you're not going to even find records. They've all burned. But Anyway, we skimmed the surface. There's so much more. You can go dig if you want. You can go on the internet. We're finding the same things just by searching the FBI government documents and the other sources that are out there. You can find a lot on these men that were connected to Gordon Lindsay and William Branham. But if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more information about Roy Davis and William Branham, you can read The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and soon, Audible.